You're listening to Freight Famous, presented by Rose Rocket, bringing you the people that make trucking move from behind the scenes into the limelight. Here's your host, Justin Bailey.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Freight Famous, a podcast produced by Rose Rocket. New episodes of Freight Famous will be released about twice a month. On this podcast, we talk with guests about how they build, scale, and automate their trucking businesses. If you have a trucking business or a transportation business or anything of the sorts, you might be looking for some software, or you might know someone who is. If you do, I've got some good news. Rose Rocket has free money to give you. That's right, free money. All through our incentivized referral program. To learn more, email us at referralpartners@roserocket.com and a member of our team will be in touch. You would think I would know this better. I read this every single podcast. I'm your host, Justin Bailey. I'm co-founder at Rose Rocket. And today I have with me the one and only Craig Fuller, the founder of FreightWaves, of Sonar, and now FireCrown. So Craig had a really interesting story to tell about how they've changed the business. And I want to say that carefully, because he was careful to tell me that the business from a FreightWaves perspective, from an F3 conference perspective, from a Sonar perspective, has not changed. But what Craig has done is he's purchased FreightWaves, sort of separated the businesses, and then it's now rolled it up into a larger media company called FireCrown. So super interesting conversation around how to build a large media company. And he is building a large media company. He's making a ton of acquisitions. It's a pretty cool business that he's putting together over there. I really had no idea before the show. And then just talked a little bit more about Sonar and data, and you know, just the journey of you know, from just having an idea to building a $300 million data product and starting out to build an emerging media empire in and around the transportation, aviation, marine space. So be sure to listen. Great conversation with Craig Fuller, as it was last year too. Craig, thanks for being here.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Do you even listen to your own stuff?
Not really. I know I probably should, but I used to when I first started doing this, but I do it quite often. So
yeah,
now I don't tend to do that.
So. Yeah, I hear you.
I think when you first doing it, it's almost like watching a football player, like watching film on what they did wrong.
Yeah.
Or trying to improve their game. But now I typically don't, unless I'm like, dude, I was like really bad on that podcast and like listening in to make sure I didn't say anything stupid. And then usually I'm like, okay, I actually sound pretty good, but, it depends what kind of mood I'm in.
I almost get, it's the verbal tics that I'm listening for. And I find that I struggle to actually eradicate them. So I've stopped listening because they almost annoy me more now. I'm like, ah, shit, I can't get rid of that thing anyway. So it's like, I don't even want to hear it anymore. So yeah, I hear it. I'm kind of in the same place. Especially when I'm interviewing, although, you know, this is a bit like this. I can't believe I'm about to admit this, because not many people besides my wife know this, but I really do still enjoy listening to myself being interviewed. I think that's a total ego play for sure, but I still actually do. As an interviewer, I'm far less likely to listen, but as an interviewee, I still, it's so embarrassing to say this out loud, but yes, I still like the sound of my own voice, I think, a little bit.
I think part of it is you're like, oh, I do know this topic better than I thought I did.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
There's been times when I've been on like Bloomberg will call me in, or a major network will call me in for something, and they ask me about a topic I don't know very well.
Yeah.
And I'll do a 30-minute conversation about like global shipping, which I'm not a global shipping expert.
Right.
I did this whole thing about the sort of Red Sea attacks, and I didn't listen to it, but I get all these people were texting me like, holy shit, you know, like that was a great podcast. I'm like,
yeah,
dude, I thought it sucked. I was like, literally, like, I thought making shit up as I went.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wasn't. I actually listened to it. I was like, oh, I actually do know a whole lot more than I give myself credit for. So I've done that, but not typically. And you know, the thing is, when you live and breathe this stuff every day, I don't tend to study freight stuff on the weekend. Like I'm not consuming freight and supply chain stuff typically on the weekend, unless there's something big happening. Like I want to get away from it as much as possible.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that. Again, this is sort of like an admitting thing that I struggle with, but like, I don't know that I've ever been in love with Freight, you know, as a means, you know, it's like, it's something that I do and it's been very good to me, in my life. And I'm grateful for it. And I appreciate what it is, but because even saying this right now, I feel like I'm having to justify like the preamble, but there are people that I know, and I bet, and you know, for sure too, that are just like, they love it. Like they love it. And I don't have that same relationship with it personally.
I mean, I grew up in it, so I think I do love it. I think part of it is, though, you spend so much time talking about it through the week and so much time like studying it that you need something else to divert. You know, it can, for me, it's just a diversion of something outside of the industry. But I grew up in it. So for me, it's sort of, I love talking about the history of it. Like, I think that I always sort of enjoy doing is like going back into the like ancient history of freight and having a conversation about how we got here kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just because I think it's so fascinating. And a lot of that is sort of like tribal like stories versus stuff you find in a textbook. I think that stuff's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's like almost the anthropology of it, right? Like you like that context. I think for me it's like my wife owns a freight brokerage. She also comes from it, like 100-year-old trucking company, family type thing. And so I think it's just, it's around, to your point, like it's around me a lot. So it's like, it's around me here. It's around me when I, you know, go to trade shows. It's around me when I go home. And so I think in sort of the not loving it, it's almost like, I feel like it takes up at times too much space, you know?
Yeah. I think that's fair.
So I did want to talk to you about practical things. I saw not to say this isn't practical, but I saw personally an email, I guess, come across that talked about a change at FreightWave Sonar, the relationship between them. And I really just, at that moment, I was like, I'd like to talk to you to kind of find out what's been going on and dig in a little bit. And so, yeah, I mean, you want to just kind of give the audience and myself just some context and some communication on what's going on?
Yeah, so we, you know, effectively FreightWaves has had three different businesses in one. You know, it was, we have the media business, which is advertising monetized. We use advertising to monetize it. It's, you know, the site is essentially free. We don't charge subscriptions or anything. Then you've got the events business, which is in-person physical events, F3 and future supply chain. And then you have the data business. And I think our board, which is venture capital supported and backed, realized that there was a need, because these businesses are essentially the future buyer of FreightWaves is unlikely to be a media buyer, because data is a different business and there is a much different type of buyer that buys data businesses. So we realized that, you know, we had the opportunity to sort of split the businesses, and that's what we did. So we executed a split in early February of splitting the media business away from the data business. I actually acquired the media business personally. It was a personal investment. And now it is a separate business.
Where does the events slot into that?
The events stay as part of the data business. So it is common for SaaS businesses and data companies to own an events business. That is not an uncommon business model, and this was the chance to do so.
And are you stepping away? How is Sonar being? Are you running Sonar still, or in the events? Okay, so you're acting. So you've got the media business, which I appreciate that you're rolling in. And sorry, I don't recall. Talk to me about the. It's going to sound like, I sound like a child. It's like my kid when I'm saying this. Like the airplane stuff. Like what is that? What is that part of it?
So we are the largest publisher of transportation related media businesses. So we have a big aviation part of it. We've done about 17 acquisitions. About 30, I think 37 brands is what we've acquired so far, but in aviation, which is everything from pilot flown aircraft to commercial aviation to military, but basically we own a bunch of brands that really sort of focus on the $1 trillion global aviation industry. And then we had the opportunity, and we did execute this, to buy the largest marine, which is boating, yachting, sailing, fishing publisher. So now we're the largest marine publisher. And so that is really what is known as Firecrown, which is both marine and aviation. And then we're now bringing supply chain news into that business as well.
What's the vision there? I mean, that's, I don't understand the industry. I get the tech side almost can feel like we can just, I don't want to skip over. I think we should talk about it, but I get it personally at that level quite well. Talk to me about how a business like this is constructed. What's the vision and how do you see this kind of unfolding over the next, call it, 5-10 years?
So FireCrown is the name of that media entity. And essentially FireCrown is, this is something I discovered at FreightWaves, which was the media business provides a very effective top of funnel for our data business. So essentially the media business is generating advertising revenues and contribution margin through advertising. And that's really, we were successful at doing that, but we also, as a byproduct of it, had a data business and we're providing top of funnel.
I just want to ask something there. Was FreightWaves the original a concept and then the data was born out of that, or was FreightWaves designed as a top of funnel product for the data?
No, it was the other way around. Data was first.
Right.
I never imagined we would be a media company. In fact,
right.
If you looked at our original pitch deck, it didn't even make it. So
was it really designed for that purpose?
It was designed to create top of funnel and then
smart
education and engagement for the data. We just happened to be really good at it.
I mean, we
as a byproduct of building it, we were able to obviously resonate with the audience. The audience loved it, and all of a sudden we became the largest provider of news and information in supply chain globally. And so very proud of what we did there. In fact, I think in some ways you could say we were too successful at it because it became so big that most people on the street, if you asked folks what FreightWaves is, they would say a media business. 70% of our revenue did not come from media. It came from the data side of the business. And so when you look at the scale of the data business and the relative valuations of media versus data, I mean, a media businesses trade at a multiple of EBITDA and data businesses trade at a multiple of revenues. And so just two different worlds of sort of valuation. I think what we felt was, we have a lot of institutional capital behind us, a lot of investors that have supported the business. And we felt like the best thing to do was to split these businesses up and still maintain that top of funnel relationship, but essentially split them in a way that can enable our investors to realize the biggest returns.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And sorry, I interrupted you. So the vision for now, what is FireCrown? I want to hear more about that.
So I'm a strong believer that media businesses have an enormous amount of power in providing both top of funnel and shaping the way that audiences think about a topic. And I learned that at FreightWaves is that you effectively have this role in the community that is exponentially bigger than any financial profile. Media businesses are relatively small. Like even the biggest media businesses that you can think of, in terms of the scale and scope of them, tend to be relatively small versus the sort of outreach of their power they have with these audiences. That's why they end up doing other things. I mean, even if you take Disney, one of the biggest media brands on the planet, a large percent of their revenue does not come from the actual media property. It comes from all the stuff. It's toys and licensing and amusement parks and things like that. And that's the power of media, is that it tends to have a multiplier and exponential impact over the audience that's well and above the core product offering. And so that was sort of the thesis I had. I bought Flying Magazine as a sort of a side hustle passion project because I'm a pilot. And from that, as an entrepreneur, I couldn't resist myself to think, hey, I could probably try to do this top of funnel, take the media business that I own that's flying and sort of find other products that I can services I could sell to the audience. So we've made 3 e-commerce acquisitions where we are selling products that the audience wants and cares about through the aviation audience. We've bought 1,500 acres of real estate for development. We're building a fly-in community in East Tennessee. We bought a finance business. If someone's buying an aircraft, we've got to find financing for it. So that concept of top of funnel is still playing out very much inside of FireCrown. And that's really the vision, essentially, is what we're doing is we're buying up legacy media businesses, which have strongly connected audiences and engaged audiences, and then finding commercial products that we can offer those audiences that they naturally would otherwise consume somewhere else. And so that's essentially the business model, is this flywheel of taking media and audience and providing opportunities that are above and beyond what the core media business is.
So super interesting. So then from, so FreightWaves is, and it's actually what I had suspected. So FreightWaves becomes really successful at top of funnel, and to your point, maybe almost like too successful because it was watering down the relationship to Sonar and making that maybe complicated a little bit, and maybe from the investor landscape too in terms of focus, right? And I know we have focus problems ourselves, and so. As you think about, so when I think of what FreightWaves, I think of obviously a B2B offering, right? And a pretty like nuanced type thing. When I think about, you mentioned marine, and maybe this is just like, just part of the narrative, and maybe we don't have to kind of like focus in on this, but I hear something like fishing. And when I hear like, is the aviation stuff, even is this more B2C, would you say? Is there a shift in some of that?
Aviation's prosumer. So prosumer is a term that means you have professionals, it's a consumer orientation, like the products are consumer oriented, but you also have a professional element inside of that. And so the people that are, so both, you know, in aviation specifically, we talked about this very early on in the conversation when we first opened, is that I'm not doing things on the weekend to sort of consume supply chain content. Like there's, it is a functional role that I have in the industry. And other practitioners have in the industry. We care deeply about the success of supply chain and about freight. But when we are not in the freight industry, we likely have other passions that we're sort of following. In aviation, it's quite different, is there are folks that work in the aviation industry, and on the weekends, they're flying their personal aircraft, or they're going to air shows, or they're watching YouTube videos about airplanes. And there is a small segment of our supply chain industry that does that, but it's a small segment that does that. Mm-hmm. Aviation is probably the opposite. I think almost every person I've met that works in aviation as a career joined the industry because they were passionate about airplanes. And it's just sort of how the way industry is constructed. So that is our audience. We're selling to an audience that's both consumer sort of oriented and does it because they are passionate about airplanes, but also there's a large professional audience that we're also selling services to, advertising and other products. And that's essentially sort of the model. Now, you may be asking, what does a supply chain media business have to do with this broader sort of thing? Is that 75% of media is not actually value added. 75% of an infrastructure for a media business doesn't add any value to the consumer. At least they don't see it. It's all in the background. It's think about just in producing this podcast, it's pre and post production. Like, it's one thing to be the host and sort of do it, but then somebody else has to like produce it and market the product and upload it to all the podcast elements. And in a media business, you have things like what we call ad ops, which is serving up ads. You've got audience development, which is creating new audiences and continue to nurture those audiences. You have advertising sales. And so a lot of the stuff that goes into making a successful media business has nothing to do with what the consumer experiences and mostly to do with running a successful business. And so really what we got out of the FreightWaves acquisition was this really strong infrastructure. And I would argue some of the best digital infrastructure. I'm very proud of what we built in terms of FreightWaves Media, of having this enormously very powerful infrastructure that is now available to my other media brands that we have in the aviation and boating sectors, and continue to build the supply chain element. And so this, it's a really the sort of the concept behind the transaction was, it wasn't that necessarily freight content or trucking content is going to add a lot of value to the aviation audience, but it was the infrastructure itself that I thought was pretty powerful.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was going with the B2C question, is that I assume this to be an economy of scale play, where you end up with this, like you said, this infrastructure that you can dovetail some of these other operations into and just, you know, utilize the same podcast room for, you know, multiple different shows and, you know, different tracks and these types of things. But I guess my question is, how do you maintain the... because as much as these are their transportation, they're going to have unique customer bases. They're going to have unique voices. They're going to have sort of like, so how do you think about maintaining even the, you know, the reader base of these, call it say magazines or online, you know, publications? How do you kind of maintain the integrity of something that's being done by somebody else? Because there is, as much as there's like a lot of operational infrastructure behind all of this, there is still a bit of an art in this that's kind of lives in the margins. How do you maintain that, I guess, through the process of kind of bringing on all of these different organizations and companies into you know, well, kind of one area?
I mean, it's the same team. You say somebody else doing it. It's not the same. It's not a different team. It's the same team that's doing the execution.
Okay.
The reality is that what most consumers experience, if you're in supply chain or you're in aviation or you're a Marine, what you experience is the editorial voices of these products, whether it's on video or whether it's in print. Or on digital, you don't really, there's a lot of invisible resources that are ensuring that happens. And essentially they're product agnostic. Like they're really, at the end of the day, what matters is the editorial voices continue to put out content, continue to identify the stories, continue to do the programming around, whether it's a show, they continue to develop that. That's what really matters. And that's only 25% of running a scaled media business. And this is an interesting thing because I see a lot of contributors, sort of, you know, these freelance contributors that you see that have popped up all over X or now are doing podcasts, this podcast as well, is a lot of the contributors look at it and say, hey, I can be a celebrity. I can be my own person. I'm not suggesting that's what your purpose was, but I can build something that is great. And that's the easy part, is putting out the content. Doing the interviews is frankly the easy part. The hard part is all of the work it takes to go beyond it. And if you're doing it for yourself, if you're a one person producer, that's not hard to do. Like producing a single podcast is, but there's a finite ceiling that you end up getting, is you're going to continue to work on the same existing audience. Like you may scale it and continue to grow with, you know, your audience development may grow 10% month over month, which is great. But when you look at the type of scale that you need to support a large media business, it takes a lot more than that. And so when we look at what it takes to serve up those audiences, we have to have content, we have to have programming, we have to have ad ops. It's a lot of stuff that happens on the background. What most people see and identify as a media business is editorial. And we've had a lot of folks that have, you know, joined FreightWaves and then, you know, have aspirations to go out on their own, and some have done it. But then oftentimes 6 to 9 months later, you see those podcasts sort of fizzle out. Is they were on FreightWaves, they enjoyed the dopamine highs of being in front of audiences, sort of the mini celebrity that comes with being in front of people. That's all the fun stuff. But nobody really sees the stuff that goes on in the background that actually makes this stuff work. And that's when it becomes work at the end of the day, and it becomes very taxing. And I think you need infrastructure to be able to build something that's sustainable. You know, we're able to, for our contributors, take something like Dooner. Is Dooner does a lot of the work. He develops his own shows. He produces his own shows. And he, you know, from the audience standpoint, they look and say, he only works 3 hours a week. Like he does three shows, 1 hour a day. And you're like, oh, that's all you do, dude. Like, and we compensate Dooner quite well. But what they don't realize that Dooner's doing in the background is he's picking the guests. Like it takes a lot of work. And, you know, I'm a relatively easy guest for a podcast because I can just show up and start talking about a topic. A lot of guests don't require a lot of handholding, and so that takes a lot of work. And then you have the whole promoting the show, producing the show, editing the show that goes into it. And imagine doing that over, you know, dozens of shows. And so that's what an infrastructure enables you to do, is that you're developing audiences, you're growing audiences, you're providing ad operations, you're selling ads. And the thing about advertising is, if you're selling, you know, one advertising sponsor, is that, you know, you're having to constantly re-up that, because very few sponsors will take on a show inevitably or indefinitely. Is typically these relationships can be month to month or sort of quarter to quarter. They're not typically like year long recurring relationships. And so it takes a lot of work, and to be successful at it, it takes an enormous amount of work. I think anyone could be a freelance contributor, commenter, sort of celebrity influencer, if you will. That's easy if you're one, but if you want to build scale to it, it's a completely different game.
Yeah, it's hard. Like, stamina and enthusiasm will only take you so far, right? It's like you will run out of gas in that. And I can think of my own just like life, you know, in many ways where, to your point, kind of going out on your own, it's like that enthusiasm will get you off the ground, but maintaining it day over day, week over week, producing always on time, having, you know, all the necessary just the components and outputs and inputs that need to happen, like just consistency is so challenging, you know, on your own or even in small teams.
I think, you know, I see this not just in media, but I see it in almost every role. As you get a new employee, or, you know, someone who's new to the business or takes on a new challenge, and the first sort of stages of it, it's just like a video game, right? Like, when in the video game logic, successful video games, what they do is they make it easy in the first couple of stages. They want to challenge you just enough to where it creates a dopamine high, and every single stage is a new dopamine high. But there's a point when you get diminishing returns. You no longer get the dopamine highs by doing the same things. And what happens is, and I see this a lot, where you have a young employee who has had some really early success, and then things get harder. They've taken on and accomplished the easy stuff, and it all of a sudden gets to the harder stuff, and they become disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, their confidence is boosted. They've solved all these problems. And then as it gets more challenging, it's no longer the easy answers. And so all of a sudden they lose interest in the project. And I think a lot of it exists also in the influencer community, is you get a lot of the challenge of being in public and having a platform is you don't know if you can do it. You can prove yourself you can do it. And then all of a sudden you build up a little bit of sort of notoriety, fame, and those dopamine highs are big. You're getting a lot of comments. People are like, hey, it was a great show, great conversation. I really enjoyed your piece on this. Eventually that wears off. Like, I found it for myself is like the first time I went on CNBC was 5-6 years ago. And I remember texting, I was, you know, this is on national TV. I'd done some local TV, never done national TV. And I remember texting my wife. I was going from New York City, from Manhattan to New Jersey, the studios for CNBC. And I was texting my wife. We're driving over the GW Bridge. And I'm like, I want to jump out. Like, I can't do this. I was like, oh my God, I cannot do this interview. I was freaking out of my brain. And I was just panicked because I'm like, I'm going to be on national TV. And I did the interview and it was great. It was fine. Nothing, you know, none of my worst fears happened. And now I literally can get a text message from any of the national networks and be on in a minute with zero prep, going cold. And I don't think anything of it. To me, it feels like no different than having a phone call or a video call. And I think that is sort of the world of what happens in media, is once you sort of get over that initial audience and you sort of get over those initial hurdles, it becomes more of a job. It becomes more of a work. And I even think for myself, is like doing podcasts or doing TV, it oftentimes becomes much more routine. So it's not these huge dopamine highs that you get. And I think that's where a lot of this sort of independent contributor model wears down. So in order to maintain a long-term media business, you got to build infrastructure, because you got to support your contributors and you have to take off the work off them as much as possible, because they will lose interest really quickly if it becomes a lot of hard work. And I think that's where infrastructure matters. And so by putting these businesses together, we just benefit from a much larger infrastructure.
So as someone who started not to be in the media business and never really and imagined it, and now is moving towards a significant media business by the sound of it, at least, you know, via ways of roll-ups and then all the things that go along with it. And it sounds like that's the aspiration. Is this outcome one that you would define as, and I want to be careful with the wording here, because I don't want to create like a counter punch to the word, but like, is this successful for you? Or is this feeling like, I'm so glad all of this happened this way? Or do you have like some regrets that end up here? Like, what's your overall kind of feeling as you sit here and, you know, look over the last, call it, you know, 10 years on kind of this journey? How are you sort of thinking about that as you're having a moment to kind of reflect on it?
It's success beyond my wildest dreams. I mean, effectively I built multiple businesses on something I didn't know I was good at. I mean, if you think about it from FreightWaves' perspective, is the media business enabled our data business to be enormously successful without, we didn't have a lot of advertising or customers, we didn't have to go spend a lot of money sort of in customer acquisition, but we ended up building our customer go-to-market built a really successful media business. And the internet itself is a big enough business to be a standalone entity if it wanted to be. And it built a data business that's worth $300 million. So I think by every definition, I've far and above achieved every one of my goals and missions. So I don't think in any stretch that there's, the business models change. I mean, look at Brad Jacobs at XPO. When he first started, he was going to roll up all the freight brokerages and went up and acquired a lot of these logistics businesses. And then in the last 3 years, they've all split. He's sort of reversed that whole business model into three different companies. And along the way, he made himself billions of dollars and his shareholders worth, even more so. And so when you look at businesses, at times you have to sort of take a look, and what made sense a year ago may not make sense for the future. And that's essentially what we did. Is I'm very proud of the FreightWaves media business. I'm very proud of Sonar, but Sonar in many ways was overshadowed by the success of our media business. And I think what we're trying to do is give it its own sort of life outside of the media dependency and give it an opportunity to sort of thrive on its own.
Would you do anything differently looking back? And, as you kind of approach this and again, ended up here and again, wildly successful for certain, but we sometimes have things that slow us down or distract us, or we make bad bets. And, I think it's sometimes success can be hard to learn from, but at times failure is also, it can be really a real, course teacher.
I could fill a book of every mistake and failure we made along the way, but I don't dwell on many of them. I mean, it would be disingenuous to say there aren't things that still to this day grind me about that journey. But I don't dwell a lot on the things that we could have done differently. It's more of like, where are we at today and what can we do to move forward with it? And so for every success, there's hundreds of things that we messed up along the way. And I think it's important to sort of figure out what is successful and double down and reinforce those. And the things that you fail is you hope that those things were inconsequential failures, were sort of small bets that you made that didn't work out, and that you could move forward. I mean, there's still a lot of things that I would like to see us accomplish in our journey. And I don't think any of these, nothing is sort of permanent in business. And so there's always the opportunity. Timing dictates so much success. There's always the opportunity to redo things. I mean, we started out the company to be a futures market. That was the whole idea and concept behind FreightWaves Sonar. And we launched it, and it was not successful. It didn't achieve its goals. Does that mean that in a year or 2 years or 3 years that we couldn't launch it again? No, it just means that the way we did it before is not the way we would do it in the future.
Right. So how does Sonar show up now? Is there sort of a large difference in the way that you maybe want to let the listeners know? Is there a new way to think about it? Is there new leadership? I know you mentioned you're still going to be running it, so perhaps not. Is there anything, how does Sonar kind of come out of this differently? Or maybe it doesn't.
I think it continues on the path that it was on. I think it just becomes a more elevated brand. I mean, if you go and look at the size and scale of Sonar and compare it to a lot of technology companies that are in the space, it would be in the top sort of upper quadrant just in terms of its own size. But even when you go look at investor decks or these the venture capital community pitch book, and CB Insights loves putting in these industry charts of all the different companies, Sonar never got a shutout. In fact, if you go to PitchBook, and we know the relative size of a lot of companies, there's companies that are much smaller than what Sonar is that is getting a lot more attention, frankly, because we're profiled as a media company. And I think that's true in a lot of the sort of thinking about FreightWaves, is that Sonar is largely not getting the respect as a platform business that it would if it was truly standalone. Like, the size and scale of that business is such that it should deserve conversation, but oftentimes the media business was too successful. And that's great. Like, at the end of the day, I don't, I don't begrudge the success of our media business. And I want to see it continue to scale and continue to build its role and mission in this industry. But I also think there's this great product that also deserves a lot of recognition.
Yeah, there's worse problems to have than building a media business that's too successful, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately, I think what I learned about this is that your media businesses can actually incubate businesses to a point where, and if you go back to 2018, 5% of our revenue came from data. And if you go back to 2023, it's 70% of our business came from data. So like, at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, giving Sonar a life in the future where it's no longer a, you know, it's no longer a small business. It's now has a significant opportunity to continue to scale.
You know, funny thing with Sonar, I find is that I've often been, and I'm going to do it today because I'm growing brave with age. I've almost been embarrassed to ask what it is. And I think others have too. There's almost this, to your point, it's almost like FreightWaves has kind of created this. I almost felt like I was supposed to know. It was like, I don't even know how to explain this well. It was that you'd be like, well, there's FreightWaves and there's Sonar and that's a data. And it's like, okay. And you were kind of like challenged. Maybe it's just me as sort of an entrepreneur in the way I think about things of kind of seeing, okay, that was probably a top of funnel play that became a big media company. There was a gap in the market. Then the conferences would show up to support set. And then the data is kind of the long tail of all this. I'm like, okay, I kind of get it. But in the process of my brain working through top of funnel, I kind of like lost the thread on what Sonar was. So let's do this. Like what is Sonar? And the freight futures, I understood that a little bit. And I remember when it first came out thinking conceptually, this is really cool, but you know, seeing what you saw too, that there was going to be some, you know, maybe to your point, maybe it might've been early. But then thinking about what is Sonar today, is maybe, I would just personally like to understand how you view it and how you describe it. I'd like to hear it from you. What is Sonar today?
Sonar is built to be the, you know, essentially the vision for Sonar is there's all this market data that's out there. So all these companies and the software businesses that make up this space have all of this exhaust data that they go out and create, but there is no central place where all that exhaust data is available for the market. So essentially the vision for Sonar is a centralized data system for the entire industry. So it's price reporting, which is price discovery of what the price of freight is at any moment in time. So focused on high frequency answers that's happening in the market under consistent methodologies, essentially a central information source for what's the going rate, the going price in a market, both contract and spot and trucking, you know, rail, intermodal, air, ocean, but essentially a multimodal central price discovery or price reporting agency for the global supply chain. That's part of the business. The other is what we call fundamental data. As we've gone out and worked with thousands of different software vendors that have a lot of exhaust data, and those companies are very good at telling their customers what's going on with their business. What they're not good at is companies that sell workflow solutions are not good at understanding the market. They end up wanting to sell one more instance of their product or one more customer on their platform. But what they don't build is a team that actually understands how to build anonymized and aggregated data across a whole market. For them, that's an R&D function. It's not sexy. It doesn't move the needle in terms of their core ARR. So for them, it's sort of a distraction. But what we've built is a business that goes out, and that's exactly what we do, is we've built the information source for the market. So essentially, if you're wanting to understand what's moving across the global supply chain, not on a customer specific basis, but more on a market basis, that's essentially what the information is able to serve. And we've built up an API suite and we built up a dashboard, and effectively that's what we're articulating is fundamental data and price reporting is essentially the two primary functions.
Use the term exhaust data. What is that?
Exhaust data. So let's take an airline seat because we can all relate with the airlines. So if you're a customer and you're wanting to track your airplane, you care about your flight. But let's imagine that you wanted to understand, ultimately these data booking platforms of the airlines do scheduling. They tell you what your schedules are. But then all of a sudden, you know, we want to know what is the percent of seats that are sold across a whole market. Like if you're in the airline industry, you want to know how you're benchmarking against your competitors. It's not sort of core to your business. In other words, the data itself doesn't help me book an airline ticket or find out if my flight's on time. But if I'm wanting to know the on-time percentage for the entire industry or the percent of bookings for entire industry, the exhaust data is where I discover that. It's the it's the non-core data that enables the function to happen. So in logistics, examples of that are our tender rejection data is an exhaust data. So tender rejection measures the percent of truckloads that are rejected. So 0 to 100%. And essentially most of that freight is from the contract market. It's EDI and API signals. So EDI and APIs that go from shippers to carriers, essentially enable the shippers and carriers to communicate on, here's a load and I need you to pick up. Can you pick up? And the carrier responds yes or no. And what is happening, those computer systems are communicating to actually execute a transaction. They're saying, yes, I can pick up at this time, or no, I can't. Essentially, what happens when they say, no, they can't pick up, is they're rejecting that truckload. They're saying, I can't pick up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in itself, isn't that interesting? Like, that's, you just go on to the next player. And even on an individual customer basis, it's not that interesting. Maybe even in a market, it's not that interesting. But when you look at it across an entire country, you can actually understand the real-time supply and demand balance from those tender rejection data points. Is I can understand whether the market is capacity is tightening or loosening. And I can take that exhaust data that is just a function of as a sort of a result of what happened and aggregate it across the entire United States or aggregate entire lane. I can then build it into pricing models that can help predict pricing outcomes.
Got
and
it.
That's essentially what we do is we, you know, another good example of this is ELD data. So we've got all of these ELD devices out there and all of these individual ELD companies are very good at helping their trucking customers understand where their trucks are and what the hours of service availability are. What they're not good at doing is looking at an entire market and understanding the amount of hours that a driver on average is detained or where the trucks are moving and what they're doing in terms of a whole market. So let's say that you're in the oil business and you're wanting to figure out where oil wells are being drilled. Well, sand is being moved in advance. Steel is being moved in advance. There's all these products that happen well in advance of an oil well being drilled that exhaust data can sort of reveal the nature of it. And so that's what we do is we take all those data sets from thousands of different companies and put them together and we create answers and intelligence from that data.
And who's the customer of this?
So our customers are, you know, some of the largest 3PLs are many of our customers. They use it for figuring out what the clearing price in the market is. They want to know what the actual price in the, what the going rate is on a lane. So it's benchmarking, analytics, monitoring, and forecasting. So essentially benchmarking, I want to know how do I compare to the clearing rate in the market? Am I buying better or worse than the market and my competitors? Analytics is just analyzing the overall market. Monitoring is looking for any activity that's going to disrupt the supply chain or my supply chain. And forecasting is where we likely to be in a year. And so the customers in the 3PL industry are looking at what's the going rate? I mean, if you take us compared to DAT as an example, as DAT is doing process assessments, but one of the flaws in their core sort of philosophy around price assessments is they don't have a central and published methodology, a single methodology of what all rates are reported at. We publish our methodology, which means we're everybody's operating under the same set of rules. So the data that comes in is all consistent. So if you're wanting a more accurate price, and as we move into more digitization and AI, it's going to be more important to have more accurate clearing prices in the market. And as humans, as the margin profile of the industry goes down, as the potential margin consolidates, all of a sudden those basis points really matter. Those pennies really matter. And having more accurate pricing is more important. So companies that spend a lot of money on data and data scientists use our data for more accurate answers about what the going price is in a market. And so that's one example. We have shippers that buy a lot of our data that use it for contract price assessments. They want to know where they're at in the routing guide. And here's the sort of key about shippers is like, I can agree to a rate and I can do an RFP and companies can give me a rate. There's no guarantee that 3 months from now that that company is going to pick up under that rate.
Right.
And so our job is to help them figure out what is the actual risk. What's the rate that they should be locking in? And what's the risk to that rate that it actually is going to trade at the price that they've agreed to?
Right.
And so that's where the sort of forecasting element comes in, as we use a lot of data science to sort of understand that. And that's where shippers buy our data to do contract RFP management. And then we have hedge funds that buy the data to answer questions about the macro economy that they're trying to answer.
Quick pivot, just in the interest of time, but I definitely want to ask you about it. You talked about the events being broadly managed under the roof of Sonar, but as thinking about it as an independent mission, what's sort of the future of F3 in the various shows, and how are you thinking about that differently, if at all?
You know, nothing is changing in the way we're thinking about our business. This is financial engineering. That's you can think of it as financial engineering, expanding resources on the media side. But at the end of the day, the events business, we're going to continue to build on F3. It's been a really successful event. And, you know, essentially you have the same team selling the event services, designing the program in the event. So really nothing should change, at least in the immediate future.
Yeah, and I think the reason I ask it and frame it that way is not to suggest that this is born from some negative outcome. It's more to say sometimes when we have events like this, and they're rare, right? To be able to kind of go through this, as you said, financial engineering, it's a rare occurrence, and it gives us opportunity sometimes to review what we've done, where we're going, and take pause and maybe separate them out a little bit and say, you know what, this has been working really well, but as we take, especially around financial engineering, as we look at this as a separate P&L, you probably already did anyway, but as you know, you can kind of just even emotionally reconcile and looking at it and say, yeah, maybe that's not the right direction. We want to do more of this. We want to do less of this. It's just a time to reflect. So I just want to be clear. I'm asking the questions not because I have a preconceived notion of how you arrived here or why. It's more just, has there been a within this moment of change, has there been some new things that you've decided that this is a really good opportunity and a really good moment in time to like do this thing I wanted to do, or pull back from this thing we wanted to pull back from?
I think if the media business had been sold to another party, like let's say an independent media company, then I think those questions would be sort of much sort of grounded in the sense there would be a lot more like, why did you sell it? Why now? Like, but the fact that I was the buyer of it,
yeah.
I mean, I have perfect information. Like I've done 17 acquisitions in the past year. And what's interesting about this is I remember talking to the attorneys, because we had to get attorneys on both, had to have independent counsel and stuff. And our board had to independently approve it. But I remember when we're talking to the attorneys that were reviewing the documents, like I have perfect information. Like, I know exactly all of the skeletons that are in this business. I know all the problems. I know all the opportunities. It's not as if the seller has represented something and I have to sort of trust it. I actually have perfect information.
Right.
So I had perfect information to buy the media business. And I had perfect information to know that this was the right decision for Sonar. And the reason is, frankly, just because we have institutional capital. We're probably 2 years out of a process. And I think we're just trying to get the company in the best potential position to maximize the return on investment for our shareholders. I mean, we have a really successful enterprise in Sonar. And this is an opportunity to sort of help them maximize that.
Yep. It makes perfect sense. And I can see it. Why it would be that way. And so that's all good stuff, man. And really, congratulations on the success. Congratulations on building a two successful media company, buying it. I have a much better idea of what you're doing with the media stuff in terms of all these roll-ups and these acquisitions. Obviously, I had no idea about that stuff. That's pretty impressive. And I get it. So that's... yeah, man, just really, well, thanks for joining me on this. Thanks for being a leader in this space, and really just wish you tremendous success as you continue building now these companies, I guess, unchanged, but also I think from a FreightWave side specifically, like there's obviously, or I guess FireCrown specifically, there's some pretty interesting big stuff happening there. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that all unravels in a good way.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for being here, and be sure to like and subscribe if you haven't already. Be well.